Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. Appropriately enough, my name and the program's name all match. What a great day. I wish you all a happy Friday. I hope you've had a great week. Hope you have a great Labor Day weekend to look forward to. Interesting time of the year. We celebrate the hard work of Americans who are fortunate enough to have jobs in this crazy, screwed-up economy. And we also will be coming up very shortly on the hard-to-believe 12th anniversary of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001. We're going to get to that in a moment, but to begin with, for those of you familiar with me, pardon me, you know that I'm a retired INS senior special agent, and that ever since those terrorist attacks nearly 12 years ago, I have been determined to provide my perspectives on the national security issue, especially where immigration and border security are concerned, to provide some insight based on my 30 years of experience working for the old INS. But rather than go into great detail about what I did as an agent, if you go to my website, michaelcutler.net, that's one word, M-I-C-H-A-E-L-C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net, you can read about my background. You can also find my commentaries. You can also find a link to this radio program, and perhaps that's how you got here in the first place. I also write for a terrific organization known as CAPS, C-A-P-S. That's an acronym for Californians for Population Stabilization. A terrific organization. I've been writing for them for a bunch of years. They're located in beautiful downtown Santa Barbara, California. Always great visiting with them. They're great people. It's a place that is a fun place, a great organization, and I'm happy to work with them. We are on opposite ends of the country, New York, California, but every part of this country, from coast to coast and border to border, as the saying goes, is being heavily impacted by the continuing failures of our government to enforce the immigration laws, to secure America's borders, which, by the way, for the record, don't only exist along the Mexican border, but actually our border can be found in any state that has a seaport or an international airport or lies along America's northern as well as its southern borders. A point of fact, we are a country of 50 border states. And as I pointed out when I joined some folks with the Kitchen Table Patriots in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, earlier this week, we had this conversation, and I said that even when illegal aliens run the border, they don't come to the United States the way that Neil Armstrong went to the moon. They don't simply step over onto our side of the border, grab a couple of rocks, plant the flag, and leave. They're headed for the rest of the country. And yes, it's true, many of them are here because of economic hardship and opportunities that don't exist in their own countries. But the problem is that in addition to that, which does create problems all by itself, is that there are others, and not only from Mexico, and not even only from Latin America, who have come to the United States and continue to come to the United States with far more nefarious goals in mind. Reality is hundreds of American cities are now infested by members of the Mexican drug cartels, members of MS-13, members of the Russian mob, members of Asian organized crime, the Jamaican posses involved with narcotics trafficking, and the list goes on and on and on. No society, no culture is immune from having criminals within it. That just seems to be a part of the human condition. You cannot name a society that is free of crime or free of corruption or free of those things that create headaches for the decent folks. So this isn't about racism. It isn't about bigotry. It isn't about nativism. It's simply about having our country live up to the same standard that we do when we look through the peephole before we would consider allowing a stranger into our home. And that's really where the focus needs to be. I'm going to be joined shortly, by the way, by a good friend, Mark Hager, who is a history professor in North Carolina, also the force behind an amazing documentary that you can see online. In fact, I'm very proud of the fact that I was in his film, Freedom Under Fire, Part 2. He came to New York. He filmed along the border. And again, go to my website, or if you hang in there a little bit, Mark will be on to talk about the film that he did. This is about a year ago now, and the other aspects of the immigration crisis that are impacting North Carolina, impacting New York and Chicago and Texas and Ohio, as I say, coast to coast, border to border. And there is such a disconnect between our politicians and reality that it absolutely boggles my mind. In fact, an interesting story. August 16th of this year, Mayor Bloomberg, who fortunately is almost done, we're almost done with him. He's ending his third term. Remarkable, isn't it? This was a guy who, when he ran for mayor the first two times, I will be honest with you, I voted for him. The third time round, he said, you know, I'm going to run again. This was a guy who had previously said that it would be disgusting to run for three terms, and then he goes and runs for three terms. This is the guy who's fixated on too much salt and sugar in our diet, in part to give himself this aura of being benevolent, but on the other hand, I think he's concerned about the cost of health care and how it affects his buddies in the insurance business, whether it's the people that die young and the families cash in on their life insurance policies. If they live longer, they get to put more money into those policies. Healthcare insurance, it's all about money for Mr. Bloomberg, and that's why he's so wealthy, I guess, which is fine. That's how democracies work, and that's how capitalism works. But the idea that he will put so much effort into warning us about salt and sugar, not say a word about heroin or cocaine, I doubt he's listening, but if you are, I'd like to know why you don't think that this is something worthy of anybody's attention, Mr. Mayor. But in any event, on August 16th, he was at it again. He went off on a rant and said that the city of New York should be fingerprinting all of the people who live in public housing. He said because what they have are people who are trespassing into public housing. And back on October 12th of last year, the headline blared, New York's Mayor Bloomberg demands trespassers be prosecuted. So he wants people that trespass in public housing prosecuted, people who rent apartments in public housing be fingerprinted. But when you trespass in America so that your true identities and your true intentions for coming are unknown and unknowable, well, then Mr. Bloomberg is just happy with that. That's hunky-dory for him. Just, I guess, don't do it in public housing, but you can do it to America. The disconnect is mind-boggling. I really think that the man lacks mouth-ear coordination. I don't think his ears hear what his mouth is saying. I mean, there's just no other way of explaining how in the world Mayor Bloomberg, who I would presume is relatively intelligent, could ignore the obvious fact that trespassers are a problem. When people sneak into a building, when people sneak into a country, it's a problem because we don't know who they are. And we don't know what it is that motivated them to commit that break-in, if you will. And here was the quote from the news report, and it just absolutely put a ribbon all around the whole Bloomberg disconnect. Bloomberg said, now I'm quoting, "The people that live there in public housing, most of them want more police protection. They want more people. If you have strangers walking in the halls of your apartment building, don't you want somebody to stop and say, who are you? Why are you here?" This is Bloomberg saying this. I mean, stop and think about it. Mayor Bloomberg said that if there were people wandering around in an apartment building, again the quote, "Don't you want someone to stop and say, who are you? Why are you here?" You know, those two questions are remarkable, especially to me, and I'll tell you why. At the very beginning of my career, going back to October 1971, I entered on duty as an immigration inspector, and I was assigned to John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York City. And we used to joke that if it walked, crawled, or flew, it would probably show up in New York because it's just that kind of a major international airport. We would get movie stars, all sorts of celebrities. I met incredible people there, whether it was Elizabeth Taylor, Jerry Lewis, Richard Burton, Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb. These are all people who came through my booth at Kennedy Airport. So we met everybody, and we saw all kinds of characters coming in as well with forged documents, criminals wanted for arrest, not only in New York, not even only in the United States, but people of interest to our allies around the world. So it was really a hub of activity for humanity crossing an international border, which is why New York, as I always like to say, is certainly a border state. And among the questions that as an inspector you would ask is, who are you and why are you here? And when somebody evades the inspections process, nobody gets to ask them, who are you and why are you here? And yet Mr. Blumberg has no problem with it, but he just wants that question asked, I guess, when you walk into public housing. If you walk down the streets of New York, he wants the cops to be able to stop and frisk you on the suspicion that you might be up to a crime. And I don't have a problem with stop and frisk, depending on how it's done. It makes sense that we're concerned about violence. But the disconnect is mind-numbing. And it's not just Bloomberg. We had the same problem with Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani maintained the sanctuary city policies of his predecessor, Ed Koch, who was basically doing what Dinkins had done. Koch was pretty good on it, and then he softened because there was political pressure being applied. And I don't know if you folks remember the story, but there was a young police officer, Robert Machado. He was 24 years of age. Robert Machado encountered an individual by the name of Ronaldo Rayside, a convicted Panamanian drug dealer. I had previously deported this piece of work, Ronaldo Rayside, several years earlier. He had had a green card. He lost that green card because of his convictions for narcotics trafficking and related crimes, including firearms, as I recall, and other crimes of violence. So we deported him, and he came back. Giuliani was the mayor at the time. Twice, not once, but twice, members of the New York City Police Department arrested Ronaldo Rayside. He was a convicted felon reentering the United States, and we're going to get to the significance of his being a convicted felon momentarily. But the point was they arrested him for whatever criminal violations. They ultimately released him. Each time his arrest record reflected that he had resisted arrest, and the third time was certainly not the charm for 24-year-old Robert Machado. He and his partner encountered him in Brooklyn. He was part of the Brooklyn South Task Force. Machado and his partner were, and I worked very closely with the Brooklyn South Task Force when I was an INS agent. Machado's gun was grabbed by Rayside. Bullets flew, and that young police officer died on a street corner in Brooklyn in large measure because of the sanctuary policies of the New York City Police Department carried out at the behest of Mayor Giuliani, because we don't want to bother people who are here illegally. After all, it's not a big deal. You should know that Robert Machado's wife was pregnant with a daughter he would never get to see. Years later, 20 years later, I walked into a supermarket, went into a line. The young lady working the cash register was wearing a miniature police badge, an NYPD shield. I asked her who the cop was. She said it was her father. She didn't seem to have that much emotion attached to it, which seemed strange to me. And then she told me that her dad had died before she was born. And I put two and two together, and I asked her if her last name was Machado. She said it was, and I couldn't stop shaking. This was Robert Machado's daughter. I had testified at the murder trial. It was horrible. I've since spoken with, and in fact, in the old days, I did an internet video program. I interviewed his brother, Thomas Machado, who would himself become a New York City cop, following in the footsteps of his older brother, Robert. He's now retired, living in Florida, working as a police officer down in Florida. But Thomas Machado spoke at length about what the death of his brother did to him, his family, his parents who are now deceased. It destroyed the family. And all of it was preventable if the NYPD had notified immigration, if we had taken this guy into custody, he wouldn't have been at large. So this is the situation that we're now dealing with. So we're being told on the one hand that, you know, by Bloomberg, oh my God, if you're wandering around the housing projects, we got to lock you up because you're a trespasser. Wander around America and all's right with the world. I see my good friend Mark is on. Let me go bring him on. Mark Hager, happy Friday.
Well, happy Friday to you, and I hope you're having a good start to your holiday weekend, I guess. Is that what you call it?
I am, and I'm sorry I cut your dinner short.
Oh, no, it was one of those that, you know, down here when we order steak, we have to first wait for the, you know, we have to pick out the right cow that we want.
I was just going to say, somebody had to go out and shoot the cow, I guess, huh?
Yeah, it was one of those, and I was going, my goodness.
Only in North Carolina do you get to chase your food around the table first.
Yep.
How are you, Mark?
Well, I'm doing pretty good, and
I'm glad you could join us.
Yep, and I'm trying to catch up to with the news. I had several things that I told you that I was going to bring up, and I'm trying to pull them up for you because I've missed what you started off the show with.
Sure. No, that's okay. Sure. I was just talking about the craziness of the sanctuary policies of New York, and I was at it again with my favorite political punching bag. Well, I got so many favorite political punching bags. But I was beating up on Mayor Bloomberg today because Mayor Bloomberg, I mean, this is just so incredible. Here was the quote so that you can catch up with my audience. They're actually ahead of you today, Mark. But on August 16th, New York City's local CBS radio program posted a story that says Bloomberg said public housing fingerprinting idea stuns and infuriates residents. And here was the quote from Bloomberg, and this just blew my mind, because this is a guy that has no problem with people trespassing on America. But if you trespass on public housing, then he gets kind of crazy. And he said that the people that live there in public housing, most of them want more police protection. They want more people. If you have strangers walking in the halls of your apartment building, don't you want someone to stop and say, who are you? Why are you here? And I was making the point to my audience that is very similar to the sort of questions that immigration inspectors ask arriving foreigners when they seek entry into the United States. But if they run the border, then nobody gets to talk to them. But Bloomberg doesn't have a problem with that. He just has a problem with anybody who's walking around the apartment house without identification, or people wandering around New York City streets, but doesn't take into account the fact that the guy that runs the border and evades that inspections process, pardon me, may be up to something nefarious.
Well,
is that an amazing lack of mouth-ear coordination? He can't seem to hear what his own mouth is saying?
Well, I hope that he's realizing a couple of incidents that'll kind of shed light on some of this from some ranchers that we all kind of know out in Arizona. When you're talking about running the border, this one I think is a good one to let the audience, let their mind sink into this for a second. And that rancher comes home and looks out across his ranch and notices something is going on that's unusual and approaches his barn where he has horses, et cetera, and a number of illegal aliens take off running. So he gets, as they would say, gets on the horn with several other ranchers, tries to get a hold of the Border Patrol, which seems not really available to get there at any time.
And you mean it's like dial a prayer for atheists, you call, but nobody shows up?
And so then they do catch up with these individuals.
Yeah,
and start questioning them. Of course, you know, they all speak Spanish, you know, these ranchers that have lived there for so long.
Yeah.
And they start talking to them, and, you know, they told them they're from various states in Mexico.
Right.
You know, no two from the same area.
Right.
And that they had paid their coyote guide $3,500. We've all heard this before, right?
Sure.
Just follow along with us. They had paid the $3,500. And now that they were called and that Border Patrol was now on the way, the ranchers said, well, what are you going to do now? They said, well, you know, they'll take us back. They'll release us back on the other side of the border, and then we'll come right back.
Yep.
And the rancher said, well, how do you pay for it? He says, well, we have to pay them another $3,500. And said, well, where do you get that kind of money? Because
right.
They looked really disheveled. I mean, they looked like somebody you wouldn't want anywhere near you.
Yep.
And they said, well, we don't pay them now. We don't do that anymore. We pay them when we arrive. Mm-hmm. And he has to explain to us, they already know where they're going. And they have a coyote that is waiting in America at one of our cities, whether it's New York or wherever.
Yep.
And it's almost like they have their own system to where they garnish it from your payroll.
Yep.
So now you have to stop and think about how elaborate the system is to where they know they have control of their side of the border,
yep.
meaning the cartels.
Yep.
And now they don't really they don't have to pay them instantly to cross the border, because they know who you are, they know where your family is, and they know who the contact will be to make sure that they get their money whenever you arrive.
It's almost like they're doing the job of immigration inside the United States, but not for the purpose of protecting America, but for the purpose of their profit.
That's right. And in this case, one of them's two of them, their destination was Chicago.
Yep.
And then the same day at another ranch, a guy caught one. And Border Patrol said they wouldn't send anybody out for one. And the guy said, okay. And I guess had the sheriff's office come up there. You know, it turned out that when they got a hold of the guy, he nearly got stepped on by a horse, is how they called him.
Yep.
And when he got up, you know, he was decorated and was a member of MS-13.
Yep.
And when
decorated,
they finally got
him identified, tattoos, right?
He was already a hardened criminal alien that had been released from prison by Janet Napolitano.
Yep.
And
Mark,
was now making his way back inside the United States to work with MS-13.
Mark, when you say decorated, you're referring to tattoos,
and so
correct?
This guy just happened to be called, but the Border Patrol thought it's too insignificant for one person.
Yeah. Mark, can you hear me? Mark?
So that's just a one-day snapshot.
Mark, can you hear me?
On a 83-mile section of the 1,900 mile of just border with Mexico.
Yeah. Can you hear me, Mark?
So I hope everyone feels secure and see the reality of what's happening down there, and then multiply that by all the information that you are giving about all of the other states and
Mark,
how
can you
easy
can you hear
it
me?
Is to get into this country with other
can
people.
You,
it just makes you sick after a while.
Can you hear me?
We realize we have no real border protection.
Hello.
And you have a handful of these ranchers who are risking life and limb to try to do what the Border Patrol and everyone else has been told not to do.
Yeah. Can you hear me, Mark? Hello? Hello, Mark. Can you hear me?
Are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Hello, hello.
Can you hear me, Mark? Well, I guess we have a problem. Hang on 1 second here. Mark, can you hear me? Can you hear me, Mark? We seem to have a technical difficulty with Mark. When he was talking about being decorated, what I'm presuming he's talking about are fingerprints. Not fingerprints, rather,
hello?
but tattoos. Yes, Mark, can you hear me? Can you call me back? I think that we've got a bad connection somehow. Okay, I believe that we've lost Mark, but I'm sure he's going to be calling back in. But, you know, one of the things that he was discussing was this idea that that these people that were grabbed by the sheriffs and by the ranchers was decorated. The term decorated generally refers to the tattoos that these folks have that identify them as being members of gangs. And that's really wherein lies the problem. And then we get to another situation where I think – here we go.
What?
Mark, are you there?
I have no idea what happened. I don't even know where I was in the story.
Well, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. You had me worried there. I was wondering if anybody could hear me. I felt like we're doing that cell phone commercial. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, well,
you
like
were
in
making
my house,
the point.
Walking around.
Mark, you were making the point about being decorated, and I presume you're referring to tattoos. Is that right?
Oh, gosh. So that was the other – on the same day, you have to visualize – I won't say the name of the spot, but down in Arizona, but it's just a ranch or two apart from each other. You had incident A and then incident B, and the guy that the Border Patrol said that they weren't going to waste the time on one person.
Right, and that's the problem. And that's the problem they have is a lack of resources, and they won't come out for one guy.
And this guy wasn't just any guy.
No, I understand. Now, I'll tell you an amazing story. The New York Times was talking about what it costs to incarcerate a criminal alien, or criminal rather, not a criminal alien, but any criminals at all. And in New York, they were saying that the annual cost per inmate is $168,000 per year. Nationally, it costs municipalities $60,000 per inmate per year. So when we allow criminals into the United States, look at the economic impact that this has. They commit crime, which means people are being injured or killed, God forbid. Property is damaged. People who are injured don't go to work. Maybe they run up hospital bills. And then on top of it, we're talking about billions of dollars being spent around the United States to incarcerate criminal aliens who shouldn't even be here.
It's terrible. And the amount of money, you would think that if we could take that money, put it into enforcement, let law enforcement do the jobs that they're supposed to do, and then look at the whole fence issue.
Well,
that one of the ranchers had a person call and wanted to come down and see for himself, who thought that the answer should be to build a double row fence all the way across the border. And when they got down there, you remember in the documentary, I hope people have seen it.
Yes, I was just talking about it.
Huge floodgates that you could drive a Super Duty F-350 crew cab through.
Now, remember, Mark, we're talking about the Mexican border, which really is only secure in places, so all you got to do is go to a place where it's not secure. That's not hard. You're looking at 95,000 miles of coastline.
That's right.
And you remember when you came to Port Newark and you saw all the containers and all the ships coming in, and believe me, there were stowaways on those ships and ship jumpers, crew members who vanished into the night. Here's the figure that the New York Times article had. You're going to love this one.
All right.
The Vera Institute of Justice released a study in 2012 that found the aggregate cost of prisons in 2010 for 40 states. This is 40 out of 50 states. It leaves 10 states out. Back then, it was $39 billion, with a B, $39 billion. So imagine if, let's say, only 10 or 15% of those inmates are criminal aliens, we're talking about well over $10 billion.
Mm.
Just to incarcerate. So when people say to me, where do you plan to get the money to enforce the law and secure the border? Look at the cost just to incarcerate criminals.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all false arguments. And then, you know, you and I have had this discussion off the air.
Mm-hmm.
We're being told it's not a felony or it's not a crime to run the border, right? We've heard that story.
Right.
Well, guess what, folks? If somebody runs the border and it's their first time, then that's right. That's not a felony. If the person has been previously ordered deported by an immigration judge and leaves the country and then comes back, just like this guy Ronaldo Rayside, who killed police officer Machete, by virtue of entering the country illegally, at the bare minimum, it's a 2-year felony if that alien has no criminal convictions. But if that alien, under the law, is considered an aggravated felon, that is to say, an alien who has been convicted of crimes that resulted in his or her deportation, the maximum penalty for illegal entry after deportation is 20 years in jail. Just the act of running the border because they've been previously deported and have serious convictions. In fact, I worked with Senator D'Amato back in the early 80s to create that law. And if you want to check it out, and I don't get heavy into law, folks, you can go to my website, michaelcutler.net, or CAPS Web has it up, or I'll give you the section of law. This is all in, well, most of these laws are under Title 8, which is the Immigration Code. Title 8, United States Code, Section 1324, parenthesis B, as in boy. Those are the aliens who are criminals, who were deported, come back illegally, and it most certainly is a felony. There aren't that many federal crimes that you commit where the punishment is 20 years in jail. Even people that commit tax fraud, the most they're looking at, if I remember correctly, is 5 years in jail. So when you talk about a 20-year felony in the federal system, you're talking about a heavy-duty crime, and yet you have people like Schumer and the president and Napolitano herself, the head of DHS, the agency I call the Department of Homeland Surrender, saying, oh, it's not really a crime to run the border. It sure is if you were previously deported. So it's lie after lie. It's fantasy after fantasy. And the reality is that Americans are losing their lives. Americans are losing their jobs. We have cities going bankrupt. And now if you look at the situation heating up in Syria, Syria is an ally of Iran. Iran has Iranian shock troops arriving weekly right into Venezuela, Caracas, Venezuela. There are direct flights from Tehran, Iran, into Caracas, Venezuela. And on those flights are Iranian shock troops, what are known as the Quds, Q-O-D-Z, Q-O-D-S, depending on how you want to translate the Farsi. And in fact, about a year ago, we had a case, or perhaps 2 years ago, where one of those Quds, or a couple of them, were plotting to kill the Saudi ambassador to the United States. They were going to blow up the Saudi embassy and possibly take out the Israeli embassy at the same time. So they were captured. These folks are in large numbers right now present in Latin America. So when we hear this nonsense about whether or not we need to secure the border, whether or not we need to enforce the immigration laws, we are admitting more foreign workers into the United States every month than the number of new jobs we're creating. And when I say admitting, I'm talking about lawfully, whether they're immigrants with green cards or on the pathway to citizenship, foreign students. We have right now 850,000 foreign students in the United States. Roughly 400,000 plus arrive every year. We have the exchange visitor programs, the H-1B high-tech workers, the H-2A agricultural workers. The list goes on forever. We are admitting more foreign workers authorized to work in the United States every month than the number of new jobs being created. And in New York, according to CBS Radio, the hourly wage has actually declined this year in New York City. Prices haven't declined, but wages are declining. And when they talk about the jobs created, nobody talks about whether these are minimum wage jobs or part-time jobs or seasonal jobs. And then we're being told there's a 7.4% unemployment rate. Mark, could you imagine cooking the books any worse than that? Could Madoff do a worse job or a better job perhaps of cooking the books and to say there's a 7.4% unemployment rate?
Well, we talk about this, you know, quite a bit, you know, on the phone back and forth, being discouraged, because my biggest point out of this is that I hope, as you were already alluding to, I hope people really realize the kind of people that are coming in the United States, whether it is coming up through, say, the Tucson sector, whether it is coming in from the Great Lakes, whether it's coming in anywhere that you can think of coming into America. I'm sure that they're already thinking it, doing it, and have already gone through it. And the part that should alarm everyone is that, where are they? What are their plans? What happens if we do attack Iran or we get bogged down into a war with Syria? Then all of those forces that we don't want to talk about or don't want to look at, you know, then we'll wake up to a really ugly picture one day. And, you know, it strikes me, I was telling you yesterday, I just happened to look at one of my child's, you know, schoolwork thing, and it, yep, talking about forest fires and that 80% of them are man-made. And I remember the old Smokey the Bear commercials, yep, like I'm sure you do.
Only you can prevent forest fires. That's right.
And it's strange. I took that and, you know, just went online, and you can go to CTV News in California, and they have a map up showing all the fires currently going on, and I can't even count them all. And they're each one of them, as I started to scan through them, they're all caused by lightning, even though their own site says that 80% are man-made. And if you follow the dots, they lead right back down to the border with Mexico and follow all the way up in a line. So maybe we have found a new lightning pattern that the National Weather Service hasn't quite caught on to yet.
Maybe it goes with global warming. And by the way, how is it that we're able to predict what the weather – we can't predict what the weather is going to be in 2 days, but we know what the weather is going to be in 50 years. There's questions people should have. But by the way, as a history professor, I have to ask you this question.
Okay.
What does the term enemy line mean?
Enemy line.
When they say that the soldiers went behind enemy lines. To the terrorists, where does the enemy line exist? To America's enemies, where's the enemy line? Isn't it our border?
Mm. Well, that's where I was trying to, you were going back to one of the discussions that we had when I was in class and trying to set up an argument like I do every year when we are in Rome, was when did Rome become a sovereign nation? And we always use two dates. And one date is when they used the rule of law with the passage of Lex Hortensia. And then the other one they said you still couldn't have until they secured their borders. And this one we have in the United States, we don't, the way you're posing is really interesting because we don't really have a figurative border anymore.
It's, no, we don't, because of the global mentality.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was a very interesting report.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
We have people coming in from all over the place that ignore the border. So if they're ignoring it and we can't secure it, then the border is just wherever they happen to be attacking.
Well,
so
you know,
many
Americans
are
just
behind lines.
I was just looking at a story, and, you know, I write for Caps, and there's an article. I'm going to be incorporating it in a piece for Accuracy and Media, and I've written for them previously. And we're going to be revisiting the immigration issue. I'm working on an article for them. But if you go to the FBI website, there's a very interesting article about the George John Dutch and the Nazi saboteurs is the name of this article on the FBI website. And it talked about how eight Germans came ashore, both on Long Island and in Florida, to sabotage our factories, because this is before we were in the Second World War, but we were providing munitions and other vital supplies to the Brits. And they thought that the best way to stop our support for Great Britain was to send saboteurs here. So they came ashore, and fortunately for us, the Coast Guard or the FBI worked together. They caught these guys. They were summarily tried. Two of them wound up with lengthy jail sentences. One guy got life in jail. And I believe he was a naturalized American, so he knew his way around the United States, not unlike we've seen with some of the terrorists, right? Another
right.
guy, I think, was a resident of the United States. The others were summarily found guilty and executed within days. And the FBI has this on their website about how these people were grabbed. Let me just read the first paragraph, and I made the point in the article I wrote, is that this almost sounds like something out of a James Bond novel. Shortly after midnight on the morning of June 13, 1942, four men landed on a beach near Amagansett, Long Island, New York, from a German submarine clad in German uniforms and bringing ashore enough explosives, primers, and incendiaries to support an expected two-year career in the sabotage of American defense-related productions. On June 17, 1942, a similar group landed on Ponte Vedra Beach near Jacksonville, Florida, equipped for similar career in industrial disruption. The purpose of the invasions was to strike a major blow for Germany by bringing the violence of war to our home ground through the destruction of America's ability to manufacture vital equipment and supplies and transport them to the battlegrounds of Europe, to strike fear into the American civilian population, and to diminish the resolve of the United States to overcome our enemies. Now, think about that. Eight guys were grabbed by the Coast Guard and the FBI, and it's memorialized on the FBI website. How many people are here illegally today with perhaps the same malintent? And why doesn't anybody in Washington, well, there are a few people who get it, but why is it that the administration, the DHS, that Chuck Schumer, that Nancy Pelosi, that Harry Reid, we go on forever. Why aren't they getting it? Why don't they understand that this is no different from what happened during the Second World War, Mr. Professor? You're a history guy. Is that an unreasonable analogy?
Well, being a Southerner, then I will actually bring up, since you haven't said anything just yet, since we lost.
No, here it comes. I know where we're going now.
And that I was thinking as you were talking about Abraham Lincoln. So
yep.
Many Southerners, it's not the best president they like to bring up, but irregardless, you know, he constantly crunched mathematics and looked at the statistics, and he was, even though he could lose battle after battle after battle, he realized mathematically that it was impossible for the South to win, and he just needed the generals that would be able to figure that out, and he could not find any until finally he got a hold of Grant. And Grant looked at the math, understood it completely. And we're kind of in a situation today that mathematically, when you crunch any figure you want to, anyone that you want to go online and go and crunch, you know that the people coming across or coming into the United States, that the criminal side of it is so great that you're numbering into the tens of thousands that are here.
No, you're actually talking about hundreds of thousands. You know, there's an estimate that there are now more violent gang members in the United States, and many of them, not all of them, but many of them are actually illegal aliens. There are more gang members in the United States than the number of sworn police officers across the country.
But we cannot find the politician that can crunch the numbers and figure out that sooner or later, mathematically, we're going to be a ticking time bomb, that how we recover from it will take all of us to be able to try to overcome. It won't be just our law enforcement.
And look, and look at what happened. You know, this coming Tuesday, I'm very excited, very enthusiastic. I don't know if Lou is listening tonight, but Congressman Lou Barletta used to be the mayor of a town called Hazleton, Pennsylvania. And I was his final witness. Lou was very happy with the way things were going. He was living in the town that he had grown up in as a kid. He was happy to be the mayor. It was a peaceful, bucolic little town, you know, in the mountains of Pennsylvania. It used to be a coal mining town, Hazleton. And all of a sudden, there was violence. They had drug dealers coming in, members of MS-13. And one guy walked up to one of these thugs and said, "Hey, listen, you can't sell dope in the park. I grew up in that park. My children are youngsters. They now play in the park. Take that garbage out of the park." And in broad daylight, this guy pulled out a gun and shot this guy in the face and killed him on the spot in front of witnesses and walked away. And at that point, he realized he had no alternative but to use the immigration laws for the purpose that they were intended, and that's to prevent criminals from entering the United States and embedding themselves in communities. No sooner did he enact ordinances against illegal immigration, he was the first mayor to use that tactic, then he got sued by the ACLU, and I was called upon to be his final witness at the federal trial that followed. And Lou and I are going to be in Daytona Beach, Florida, on Tuesday on the campus of Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University at 7 p.m. We're going to be doing a live radio show on radio station WNDB that's sponsoring the trip and the event. Mark Bernier, whose show I'm on frequently, I was just on Mark's show yesterday, will be hosting this event. I understand that C-SPAN will be covering it. It's going to be posted on YouTube. But Lou gets it. There are others who get it. Jeff Sessions gets it. Steve King gets it. But what I don't understand is where these other folks are. Why in the world don't they understand that this is really a struggle for survival of America and Americans?
And that's the truth, because I can't figure that one out myself, unless they are totally, either two things, they are totally out of the loop and they're so concerned about how do I get elected next time that they surround themselves with people who don't even focus on what's really happening. They just focus on politics, or they know, and the money that's chasing behind the scenes is telling them to be quiet, or they really just don't care. That would be the third one.
But if they have children or grandchildren, they have to understand that they are going to take from their children, as certainly as a robber takes the money from a bank, they will be taking the futures of their children and their children's children.
Well, that's what we hope that they understand. Sometimes I just shake my head now and saying that if they don't understand now and cannot read these reports, read law enforcement reports or across the country, to the sheriffs or whoever, different ICE agents or whatever it is, just get on the phone and talk with them.
It's astonishing,
do that, isn't it? Then, they shouldn't be there in office anyhow. And the only way you can get rid of them and replace them is to do what you're doing now, is to educate the public and go everywhere you can to speak. But sometimes you still wonder, what is it with the public that they don't understand? Do we really have to wait until things are being blown up all around us before they finally say, wow, we got to do something? And
well, you know, it's remarkable. We're coming up on the 12th anniversary of 9/11. It only took 44 months for us to win the Second World War. It's now three times as much time has passed since 9/11 as it took us to win the Second World War. It's over 20 years since the first two terrorist attacks committed on our soil, first by a guy by the name of Cansey, who lied on his applications for political asylum, who repaid our generosity and kindness by killing two CIA officers and wounding three others. And 1 month later, February 1993, the bombing at the first bombing of the World Trade Center, six people killed, 1,000 people injured, $500 million in damage inflicted on the towers that used to be the centerpiece of the lower Manhattan skyline. Of course, they crumbled on 9/11. But had the buildings come down sideways, which they almost did, and I spoke to the folks who did the investigation of what came to be known as the crater back then, the pit where the explosion went off, and I was told by the people who were working with the civil and mechanical engineers that if they had planted more explosives in the truck, because the truck had not been filled to the top, or if they had parked it on the opposite wall, that there was a substantial chance that the tower would have toppled sideways into the other tower. It would have been cascading dominoes. Nobody would have gotten out. You could have been looking at tens of thousands or maybe hundreds of thousands of dead bodies. Lower Manhattan would have flooded. The seawall would have ruptured. And if that wasn't serious enough to get the Clinton administration to do something about immigration, so when people keep saying, well, why aren't we reacting, I don't get it. And there's another myth I want to blow up today. I love Mythbusters, except we don't use explosives, just explosive words, perhaps. We're told that it's anti-immigrant to take the position that Mark and I and Congressman Barletta and Senator Sessions and Steve King have taken. And I want you to understand what a BS story it is. And my contention is very simple. It is not anti-immigrant to be pro-American. Because if you look at Americans today, this isn't a lily-white country. Let's be very blunt, folks. I'm a New Yorker, and whites are in the minority in New York City. This isn't about race. This isn't about ethnicity. This isn't about religion. It's about making one distinction, citizens versus non-citizens. The term for a non-citizen is alien. In fact, legally, if you look at the immigration laws, the term alien that the other side won't let us use, and this started with Jimmy Carter, is here's the definition. Any person not a citizen or national of the United States. Not my definition. It's the definition to be found in the immigration laws of the United States. If you can find an insult in that term, alien, any person not a citizen or national, I want to know what the insult is. The problem is that it provides clarity. And to say that it's anti-immigrant to want to enforce those laws, here's something else I want you to think about. Under the color of those laws, under the provisions of those laws, we admit over 1 million immigrants into the United States of America every year because of those laws. So if you're saying enforce the laws, then you're also saying let's bring in more than 1 million immigrants every year. How is that action deemed anti-immigrant? We naturalize over 500,000 citizens every year, again, under those very same laws. So those laws also provide for the naturalization, whereby I believe last year we had over 600,000 aliens becoming American citizens through the administration of those very same laws that I want to see enforced. Again, how is it anti-immigrant to be supportive of laws that provides for the admission of over 1 million immigrants and the naturalization of hundreds of thousands of new citizens? Isn't this an insane situation where people make the statements and nobody bothers to stop to think, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. It's not anti-immigrant. This doesn't say kick everybody out. All it says is follow the laws that were designed to screen those who would come in. You're not antisocial if you look through your peephole when a stranger rings the bell before you open the door. You're just exhibiting common sense. What do you think of my argument?
I think it's good. And to stop and think that they won't even put the manpower that is necessary to even check the ones who are coming in the right way.
That's right. That's right.
And then number two, we don't even have the manpower now. And this is part that gets me all upset is that we have tens of thousands of veterans who are coming back from all of our wars, Afghanistan,
yep,
you name it, Iraq and such, that have been waiting now for years, just to be able to get the benefits of trying to protect all of us here in this country, and that we're just turning our borders wide open, allowing people who don't care about us in any way in, or wanting to harm us in any way. And so there's so much that all of us should be upset with.
Let me raise another question with you.
Mm-hmm.
If our politicians don't believe that it makes sense to enforce the borders because they're saying it's not a big deal, they just want to work, then why do we have a charade of inspecting passages at international airports and other ports of entry? If it's not a big deal to evade the inspections process, then why do we have an inspections process? Think how much money it costs, folks, to hire CBP agents, to hire detention officers, to hire secretaries and other support personnel, to hire inspectors to work for CBP, Customs and Border Protection, to hire consular officials who work for State Department in those countries where visas are required. I mean, after all, we now have 37 visa waiver countries, which means they don't even need to have visas to come here. So why are we spending, I don't know how many billions, I'm sure it's tens of billions of dollars a year inspecting passengers, when all you have to do is just go and run the Mexican border or stow away on a ship or come in through one of those marinas? I mean, 95,000 miles of coastline, there's no interior enforcement to speak of. Why don't we just give it up? Why not just allow airplanes that arrive from Kingston, Jamaica, London, England, Paris, France, Karachi, Pakistan, Bogota, Colombia, name the country, and just let them pull into a gate next to the domestic arrivals from Atlanta and New York and Miami and Los Angeles, and the only person that the people getting off the plane should have to talk to are the cab drivers that they're going to tell where they want to go.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, either our government agrees that those laws are important and that our borders are significant, or we should just shut down all of these operations and tell people we're declaring a free-for-all. As long as you were born on the planet Earth, we want you to come here. We don't care if you're criminals. We don't care if you have the Ebola virus or suffer from some other dangerous communicable disease. We don't care. Have a free-for-all. If we did that, how long would America last, Mark?
Well, we're approaching that already.
Aren't we?
Things that I would have never dreamt of when I was a child, like bed bugs, like having people nearby with tuberculosis again.
Resistant tuberculosis. We thought it was done with, and now it's back with a vengeance.
Mumps, measles, all of that has come back. And then you get a call from a sheriff in Texas that are alerting his own people, and this one I don't know if I've told you yet or not either, is that they're actually telling them to be on the lookout for smallpox.
Sure.
And we don't even vaccinate for that anymore, but I guess it doesn't matter anyhow. So if by looking at their mindset, when our kids, you have a massive smallpox outbreak, I'm sure they'll never trace it to uncontrolled borders or anything. They'll just say that, well, just people didn't get a vaccination.
Either that or maybe some bird flew by and it was bird droppings.
The
insanity, what I want you folks to take away from this conversation is the reality, not the lies, not the false accusations, not the propaganda. I want you all to think about this rationally and reasonably. That's what this is about. Mm-hmm. When I've debated these other cement heads, and I'm angry about it because they know that they're doing damage. These aren't well-intentioned people for the most part. I won the debates. And what they've done on most of the other programs is to simply shut down the debate. They don't want you to have those debates. I was on a program not long ago, not on Fox. I won't get into where it was. But I was basically restricted in what I could or couldn't say. And when I started to talk about the idea about the impact on unemployment, the person I was with kind of tapped me on the hand and shook no at me, as if to say, no, you're not going to go in that direction with the conversation. That's not the way that you do a news story. And I have to tell you, there are two people that I've been on with recently over at Fox. And I don't always agree with Fox. So I have my issues with them also. But I will tell you that Neil Cavuto and Megyn Kelly do an amazing job, given the climate that we're in, to have an honest conversation. Neil Cavuto live, we don't rehearse anything. Yeah, they'll know where I stand on issues beforehand. But I have never been on his set. I've been on with Megyn Kelly a couple of times. No one has ever said to me, oh, you can't talk about this or you can't talk about that. The ground rules are you got whatever it is, 3 minutes, 5 minutes. The interview I did with Megan back on May 2nd was amazing to me. It was just under 8 minutes, which, to those of you familiar with national news these days, is an incredible amount of time. No commercials, no nothing. Nonstop, 7 minutes, I think it was 52 seconds. No preconditions. You just go in there, and you call them the way you see them. That's how the news is supposed to operate, folks. Anything less than that, it's not news, it's propaganda. And it's important that we get the news. That's why I've been doing this radio program for a number of years now, because I am determined, having lived through 9/11, having experienced those ashes landing on my home, I can't get it out of my head. I'll tell you what, most New Yorkers suffer post-traumatic stress. And I remember that terrible day, September 11, 2001, we stood outside in front of our house, my wife and I, and the ashes rained down on us. And she said, you know, this reminds me of that scene from Schindler's List. Do you think there are human remains in the ashes? And they said, of course there are. Of course there are. And that night, and for nights to come, my neighbors were out wandering in the streets like zombies. Some of them were literally sitting on the sidewalk and crying, wailing, screaming. They didn't know where their wives, their children, their parents, their siblings, or their best friends, or their fiancés were. They had no idea. I remember going into synagogue the Saturday after 9/11, and half of the seats were empty. The people that were sitting there were in shock. They didn't know where their spouses, their children, or their parents were. And here we are 12 years later, as though it hadn't happened. We pay more attention to what happened at Pearl Harbor than what happened in New York City. And we were given this BS nonsense by George W. and all the other politicians. We're fighting them over there so we don't have to fight them over here. And I wanted to jump up and say, hey, George, if we're fighting them over there, where in the world were the Trade Center towers? Where is the Pentagon? Where is Shanksville, Pennsylvania? And by the way, if we're not fighting them here, why is there a Patriot Act? If we're not fighting them over here, why are we being strip searched just about to get on board a damn airplane? The truth doesn't match what they're saying, and we've got to call them on it, folks. We are fighting them over here. We don't know who's here. We don't know why they're here. And if, as I suspect, there are 30 million, not 12 million illegal aliens in the United States, I'm going to give you something to think about. The next time you're walking through your town, if in fact it is 30 million, and by the way, here's where I get the number. In 1986, when we had the first amnesty, the government told us, and I was a government agent then, we had supposedly access to the best information, it was guesstimated we would be dealing with between 1 million to 1.25 million, maybe as high as 1.5 million. We wound up with almost 4 million. If you do the same ratio, and we're being told 12 million today, conservatively, we're looking at 30 million. Guess what, folks? That's 10% of our population. So if you're walking through downtown, wherever it is you live tomorrow, and you look around you, 1 in 10 people you are passing on the street probably shouldn't be here. If that doesn't give you cause for pause, I want you to go to a doctor and have an EEG done and make certain that you're not flatlining. This isn't xenophobia. This is about making certain that we're not letting criminals and terrorists into our country whose goals are either to exterminate us or to victimize us. Those are the choices. The criminals want to victimize us. The terrorists want to exterminate us. And our government is okay with an open border and the total abhorrence of immigration laws. And when you have cities like New York, like Chicago, when you have states like the state of California that declares itself a sanctuary, and the federal government gives them two thumbs up when they should be getting prosecuted for aiding, abetting, encouraging, harboring, inducing, and shielding, then you know you've entered the darn twilight zone. Is there anything that I'm saying that you think is off the wall, Mark?
No, not at all. And you don't have to be in those cities that you were just talking about. I mean, you can be in just about any part of the United States.
Oh, absolutely. It's just that we're drawing them to those cities in droves because you have wackaloon politicians who shouldn't be in the jobs that they're in.
And, you know, here in this rural part of North Carolina, you know, we've had people linked to the Zetas. We've had People leased with the Sinaloa cartel up here. It's only a 3 days drive from here back to the Tucson sector. You
yep.
got the Great Lakes. You got, I mean, we are all being targeted. And the problem is, you know, we don't know who those people are. If you know, I'm not an anti-immigrant person, but
no.
I would like to know at least A, who they are, why they want to come here, and you know, hopefully to do what we can to help them if they're escaping oppression. Just like when you look at the Statue of Liberty, it's, you know, you're talking about our huddled masses. You know, we're not supposed to be harboring terrorists and cartel operatives and people like that. That's all we're trying to do. You know, people who want to come here, who are struggling, trying to leave oppression, you know, do it the right way, and, you know, we're
well,
here
you know,
to help.
It's interesting that you're making that point about oppression, and we can stay on for a little bit, folks, and I'd like to stay on a little bit longer, because I want to make this point, because what Mark is saying is right on the money, and it parallels something that I just wrote about. I did an article very recently for The Social Contract, and that article will be out, I guess the magazine should be out this week. I know that the publisher has finally gotten everything published. And I wrote a piece, and I said, political asylum, where compassion and the national security intersect. You know, I'm Jewish. And back when I was in high school and college, I was a B'nai B'rith president. The B'nai B'rith, of course, is a Jewish service organization. And one of the things I was very proud to have participated in the mid-60s was a demonstration outside the LBJ White House. You know, I'm getting a little older than I wish I was. Lyndon Johnson was the president. And we went there, and Dr. Ralph Abernathy, who worked with Dr. Martin Luther King, read a speech. The president sent a telegram over to us. They used to have telegrams in those days, commending us for our participation in the democratic process, because we were asking President Johnson to convince the Russians to allow Jews and other religious minorities to leave the Soviet Union, come to America, or go to whatever country would have them so they could escape the persecution that they were suffering under the regime of the Soviet Union. And I was thrilled as an immigration inspector beginning in 1971 to be called upon to admit refugees into the United States, because for me the circle had been completed. I worked to see this happen, and then to stand there and admit families, you know, a young mother and father and their two or three little children, and everybody was smiling and their freshly scrubbed faces. I mean, these people, many of them were crying. They were hugging each other. As soon as I handed them their documents, they shook my hand. Some of them hugged me. I had people crying on my shoulder thanking me because this was a lifelong dream of theirs. And then we're finding out that terrorists, just like Cansey in 93, use political asylum as a means of entering the United States and embedding themselves here. The 9/11 Commission warned about that. They absolutely said this is a danger. And in fact, here's a paragraph, it's a short paragraph, from page 47 of the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. These were the folks who worked on the 9/11 Commission report. In fact, I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission. Let me read this short paragraph, folks. Once terrorists had entered the United States, their next challenge was to find a way to remain here. Their primary method was immigration fraud. For example, Yusuf and Ajaj concocted bogus political asylum stories when they arrived in the United States. Mahmoud Abu Olima, involved in both the World Trade Center and landmark plots, received temporary residence under the Seasonal Agricultural Worker Program after falsely claiming that he picked beans in Florida. And then on page 98, there's this one more paragraph. Terrorists in the 1990s, as well as the September 11th hijackers, needed to find a way to stay in or embed themselves in the United States if their operational plans were to come to fruition. As already discussed, this could be accomplished legally by marrying an American citizen, achieving temporary worker status, or applying for asylum after entering. In many cases, the act of filing for an immigration benefit sufficed to permit the alien to remain in the country until the petition was adjudicated. Terrorists were free to conduct surveillance, coordinate operations, obtain and receive funding, go to school and learn English, and make contacts in the United States, acquire necessary materials, and execute an attack. So what we are witnessing is a complete meltdown of the immigration system that stands between us and those individuals from around the world, whether they're transnational criminals or international terrorists. The body that's supposed to act as our defender has been gutted, emasculated, and ordered to stand down. Ordered to stand down. Ordered to give identity documents to hundreds of thousands of dreamers without so much as a face-to-face interview. How in the world do you give people identity documents that they can then use to get Social Security cards and, in many states, I'm against this, but in many states, driver's licenses? We know that that's how the terrorists were able to enter the United States and attack us. This isn't about saying if you're from Mexico, we're going to treat you differently. If you have brown skin or green skin or purple polka dots, we're going to treat you differently. No, we're just saying that the law says we need to screen the people, no matter what their color, race, religion, or ethnicity, to make certain that among those coming in, we are not dealing with terrorists. We're not dealing with criminals. We're not dealing with human rights violators. We're not dealing with spies. And we're also making certain to protect the jobs of American workers who are losing their homes to foreclosure. There was a story on the news today how Detroit is trying to get funding from the federal government to clear up urban blight. And do you know what the tactic is that they're resorting to? This is similar to a story that was on CBS 60 Minutes about a year or two ago. They don't have the money, so the federal government is giving money to Detroit to knock down vacant housing.
Yep, I saw that.
So you watch these wreckers come in to level houses, homes that people had grown up in. They're gone. They are now empty spaces with grass growing, and that's far better than housing. So now ask yourself, the families that lived in the houses that lost those homes to foreclosure, where are they? Are they homeless? Are they living in shelters? Nobody did the part B of that story. What happened to the residents of those houses? Our population isn't shrinking, it's increasing. So if you're leveling thousands of houses, then obviously the people that used to live there aren't living there anymore. We are living in an era of economic hardship that's mind-boggling, and nobody seems to want to get it. I have to read something, Mark. This comes from an editorial written by Mortimer Zuckerman, the chairman and editor-in-chief of U.S. News & World Report. This was February 1st of this year. And here's what he talks about when he talks about the American economic crisis. But he never talks about immigration. That's what's so mind-boggling. This is Zuckerman's words, not mine. Today, millions are assisted by checks from Social Security and by food stamps. Food stamp enrollment has been rising at the rate of 400,000 per month. 400,000 per month. More than 47 million Americans now depend on that program, an almost incredible record, for it is 15% of the population compared with the 7.9% who received food stamps from 1970 to 2000. Meanwhile, nearly 11 million Americans are now collecting federal disability checks from Social Security, and half have signed on since President Obama came to office. In 1992, there was one person on disability for every 35 workers. Today, it is one for every 16. More than doubled, right? Such an increase simply cannot have been caused by direct disability experience during employment. This is, in effect, another unemployment program, one without end. Many of the people on disability would normally be considered unemployed. So, again, this comes back to this absurdity, this obscenity of talking about a 7.4% unemployment rate. Look at what Zuckerman has to say. Understand the magnitude of the problem, and that you have millions of Americans out of work, but you also have millions or more illegal aliens working in the United States. And we're being told we need to bring in more foreign workers. We're being told by Gates that if we don't bring in foreign entrepreneurs and foreign students, America is done. Well, guess what? Gates was born in the United States. No one can argue he's an entrepreneur and a very successful one. Bloomberg was born in the United States, another entrepreneur, mega wealthy. Zuckerberg of Facebook fame, also, American entrepreneur, very wealthy, and they're all screaming the same thing. We need to bring in foreign entrepreneurs. Really? Then how were they able to make all their billions, if we need to import foreign entrepreneurs? And if you look at Elon Musk, yes, the founder of PayPal, the founder of Tesla Motors, the electric car company, and he's also the founder of SpaceX, is brilliant. He's a genius. He's an engineer. And he's a foreigner. He was born in South Africa. But guess what, folks? The system worked. The immigration system provided him with lawful resident status in the United States. If he didn't get a green card, if we were trying to deport Musk, I would say, yeah, the system is screwed up. No, Musk got himself a green card. He's here permanently. So what exactly is it that we're trying to fix? How about fixing America's unemployment rate? How about fixing America's crime problem? How about protecting America from the threat of international terrorists? I must be going out of my mind, Mark. Am I crazy?
No, but we can surely get crazy if we continue to be yelling and people aren't grasping as quickly as we feel that they should.
Well, what I'm going to ask all of you folks to do, for those of you listening this evening or whenever, please tell your friends about the program. You can go to the archives. You can listen to these shows long after they're completed. All of my programs are up on the archive. I'm trying to provide you with the information that you're not going to get on the regular networks. Not long ago, I did two interviews with an old colleague and friend, Jerry Casale, who was a headquarters immigration officer. He worked in the division of USCIS, Citizenship and Immigration Services. He and I were inspectors together initially at Kennedy Airport, and he talked about the lack of quality control to the way that we're granting lawful status and citizenship to aliens every single day. Important stories. It's always good to bring Mark on. Mark is a good friend. His perspectives are amazing. And I know you have or you had a radio show. I hope you're back on the air soon on your program down in North Carolina. And your perspectives, and when you look at the documentary that you filmed, both down on the border and when you came to New York to Roosevelt Avenue, where it was a funny story there, folks. We drove down Roosevelt Avenue, which is ground zero for the drug trade, where the money all evaporates. That was originally predominantly a Colombian situation. Now it's more Mexican. They've taken over the drug trade from the Colombians. The Colombians are looking to shield themselves from the potential of arrest and prosecution. So we drove through there at about 12:30, 1 o'clock in the morning, and I thought it was going to be relatively quiet, and I was going to show Mark where we would come back the next day and film. Well, fortunately, Mark and his colleagues had their camera with them, so we realized that this was the best time to film because here we were nearly 1 o'clock in the morning, and but for the lighting, it could have been 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The money wire services that move megabucks, tens of billions of dollars of American money out of the country every year in Roosevelt Avenue, they now operate 24/7. That's a new development even for me with my experience working on the drug task force. So we filmed all that, and it's in his documentary, Freedom Under Fire, Part 2. It's a free documentary. This wasn't done for profit. It was done to educate all of us. You can find it at my website, michaelcutler.net. It's Freedom Under Fire, Part 2. You can go to Google it, and you'll find it there as well. But please understand the magnitude of the problem. Please understand that when the government fails to secure the border and enforce these common-sense immigration laws, that what they're doing is endangering the lives and livelihoods of every single citizen of the United States. And we, the people, are the only ones who can change this dynamic, but only if we become involved. That's why I always like to remind people that democracy is not a spectator sport. Do you have any final thoughts, Mark?
I mean, that's right on the money. It's democracy, as Franklin and others stated, you know, it's only one election away from losing.
Yep.
And, you know, we are fast getting to a point to where, number one, people don't really know the history of this nation, and they definitely don't know very much at all about the Constitution. And I think that works kind of part and parcel that we have raised generations now that, you know, their information they get comes from some sort of music show on the radio or from whatever somebody texts to them that they know, and they've basically tuned out from reality, even though if someone could just get them to just stop, just slow down, just stop texting for a minute, just go outside, look around your city, think about it, talked to a few people in law enforcement, wonder what's happening with the jobs, then immigration will be hitting them, you would think, square in the face.
Yeah, so, I mean, this isn't a conservative issue, folks. This isn't a liberal issue. It's not a conservative. This is an American issue. I mean, do you think did Democrats or Republicans think that having the enemy invade America is a good idea? You know, political ideology generally doesn't constitute a suicide pact, you know?
Mm-hmm. I know.
Crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, and so we just, you know, you just keep doing what you're doing and need to get you everywhere possible. I know you don't have enough time to be everywhere at one time, but because you have such a good grasp of the whole situation as a whole, not just what's happening on the border with Mexico, but everything universal.
Yep.
And, you know, if we don't get people to at least just stop and think, talk about it with your family, talk about it with your kids, and hear what they have to say and talk about it as a family, that's where it's going to have to start. And until we can reach those kind of people, we're just waiting for the next 9/11. And you know, I'm just afraid as much as what you all saw, that we could be setting up for something so much worse than what happened there. And it didn't need to happen. You know, we have enforcement. Just let them do their jobs. Just for the sake of safety, just slow everything down on the border so we know who everybody is. Slow down all the customs inspections. Everything is good. I mean, that's all that I ask. Let's just go by the rules.
Yep. So isn't it remarkable, though, when you say follow the immigration laws that permit for the admission of all those immigrants and all the non-immigrants, that permits for the naturalization of United States citizens? It's all the immigration laws that I favor. How in the world can you be labeled as being anti-immigrant when those laws provide for legal immigration? I mean,
that's
it's a
right.
non sequitur. It just absolutely makes no sense. But there are people that will listen to that and say you hate immigrants. Well, the laws that we're talking about provide for their lawful admission, over 1 million a year. I want the system to have integrity, but that's the only issue that I really take with it. We could tweak it here and there. There are a couple of things I would change a bit. But basically, the way the law is the way it needs to be enforced. So you're being told that you're anti-immigrant if you favor the enforcement of administration of laws that provide for the greatest influx of immigrants, not only of any country, but of all the other countries of the world combined, and somehow the other side has the chutzpah to say, well, you're anti-immigrant, and most people aren't smart enough to figure out that it's a bald-faced lie. That's wherein lies the problem, folks. We are smarter than that as a people. We need to demonstrate that we're smarter than that. And then we need to translate that understanding in honest conversations with our elected representatives to let them know that we are not as dopey as they hoped we were.
Well, that's correct.
So, Mark, I want to thank you so much for joining me this evening. It's always great chatting with you, whether it's on air or off air. I just hope I didn't give you indigestion as you bolted for your telephone so you could join me on the air tonight, even if we had a little rocky start with the communications at one point.
That's just, you know, with the holiday coming up. In fact, as soon as I hang up, I've got to get back to family, and which is always good. We've got some that have come in we haven't seen in a while, but like always, I enjoy talking with you immensely, and we consider you a close friend down here in Dixie. And
yep. And I still don't hold it against you that you all lost the war, y'all.
I know it.
I always tease Mark about this. You know, whenever I go to North Carolina, and I can't wait for my next trip down, we're always taking these tours of where Daniel Boone lived, and we went to the cemetery to see where his family was buried. But I always keep reminding Mark that they lost the war. It's just something that I have to do to help him maintain his perspective on reality. All kidding aside, I feel as though our families have adopted each other. And, you know, that's the amazing thing, folks, that I want you to focus on, my final thought for the day, especially as we prepare to celebrate Labor Day, which is really a celebration of the most productive, the most dedicated workforce in the world, and that's the American worker, no matter what industry we're talking about. We work the hardest, the longest hours, and we're the most productive. It's an amazing insult and an outrageous insult when people talk about the work Americans won't do. But this divide and conquer strategy of the other side has to stop. Mark and I couldn't be more different or more similar. Mark is a devout Christian. I'm a Jew. Mark is a country boy. I'm about as city as they get. I'm a northerner. He's a reb. He's a rebel. but at the end of the day, we're good friends, and we're Americans. And I don't care where you stand on issues that I may not agree with. That's our birthright. That's what the First Amendment is about, the right to peaceable assemblage so we can have the discussions and the debates. The only thing that's anti-American is if you refuse to engage in an honest, reasonable, peaceful discussion to work out differences. That's what the Founding Fathers had in mind for us, to sit down the way we do on this radio show every week, have the honest discussions, perhaps have disagreements, but to arrive at understandings of issues that would not otherwise be possible. And as a history professor, and I know you're very strong on the Constitution, don't you have the sense that this is exactly what the Founding Fathers had in mind, Mark?
I sure do. And I know that, you know, sometimes I feel going away, and we do, we have to go. But, you know, I kind of feel now that the Founding Fathers, you know, when they finished, I wonder how many of them were going, I hope they understand what we've done.
Yep.
And I wonder how long that they will continue to understand, or did we all do this for nothing?
And so many of them paid with their fortunes and their lives. I mean, you know, as they warned each other, this what they were doing was viewed as treason back then.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the way we honor the gallantry of our soldiers, the way we honor the brilliance of the Founding Fathers and the hard work of our Americans is to make certain that we get our voices heard by those who purport to represent us, folks. And that's the job you have to do. My purpose for being here is to provide you with the information, the ammunition, if you will, so that you know whether or not you're getting reasonable responses from those people who claim to be representing you. We need to hold their feet to the fire to make certain that they really do represent you. Mark, I'm going to wish you and your family a very happy Labor Day weekend.
Same to you. And to all the, and to everyone up there in New York or wherever.
Well, I thank you, Mark. It's always a delight to chat with you, and I'm sure we'll speak over the next couple of days.
All right. Well, I thank you very much, Mike.
Great having you on tonight. Thanks so much for joining me.
Okay.
Be well. Yep.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Now, that was Mark Hager, and I'm glad that you folks are taking the time out to listen to this program. As I say, I really am determined to provide you with the perspective that you're not getting from the major programs. This issue is as vital and as central to anything you could possibly imagine. If we can't secure the borders against those who would do us harm, if we don't have the will as a country to enforce the laws fairly and equitably, to make certain that those who would come here to do harm to us, then we are in deep trouble. A government's primary responsibility is to ensure the safety and well-being of its citizens. If it can't accomplish those two primary goals, then nothing else that the government accomplishes is worth anything. Only you can get the message out to your elected representative. I ask you, as Congress is preparing to reconvene in the next couple of weeks, to make certain to get your voice heard by those people who are supposed to represent you, especially in the House of Representatives. I'm going to be traveling with Congressman Lou Barletta to Daytona Beach on Tuesday. I'll be back in New York on Wednesday. And I hope when they put it out there on C-SPAN that you will have the opportunity to see it. If you want to be on my email list so that I can send you notices of upcoming events and commentaries, you can reach me through michaelcutler.net. You can also reach me through Californians for Population Stabilization. I'm accessible, and if you know of speaking opportunities around the country, as Mark said, this is something that I am determined to do. I was in Pennsylvania last week, Florida on Tuesday, and then I'll be going out to a country club on Long Island this coming a week from this Sunday. So I am on the road, as they say, trying to provide the perspectives that, frankly, you're not getting anywhere else. Well, again, it's good to wrap up the week with all of you. I thank you for joining me. Please remember, folks, democracy is not a spectator sport. I look forward to speaking with you again next week at the same time. Meanwhile, have a wonderful Labor Day weekend. Good night, everybody.